Welcome to Speaking Out.
Mainly discussing land rights and economic empowerment.
Aboriginal enterprises in mining, exploration and energy.
I'd like to talk a little bit about Indigenous constitutional recognition.
With Larissa Berendt.
It's a fresh view coming up.
On ABC Radio.
There was the first meeting of the Senior Advisory Committee, and it's really just a very initial meeting to understand that there will be subcommittees or other committees that are under the Senior Advisory Committee looking at what the regional structures should be and what the national structure should be and how they should be brought into effect.
Government action this week on the proposed Indigenous voice to Parliament and something for everyone. The Sydney Festival set to deliver a packed program of critical art and cultural performances.
For me, I've always loved new work, and so this year we've got 46 new commissions, which is a pretty massive undertaking. But then you go, there's always something in the free environment that people should bring families and kids to and things. So what I need to do is always stay very open. And I think every good arts leader should be open to discussion and debate and new ways of working, and that the festival doesn't become stuck in its history.
This is Speaking Out. I'm Larissa Berendt. With the holiday season looming, it's time to consolidate the achievements of the past year and look ahead to the work yet to be done in the coming months, and for an in-depth look at the advances and shortfalls in the Indigenous affairs sector, we couldn't go past Auntie Pat Turner. Auntie Pat is the CEO of the National Aboriginal Community Controlled Health Organisation and is widely recognised and admired as one of the country's most senior civil administrators for Indigenous affairs policy. Auntie Pat, welcome back to Speaking Out.
Thank you very much, Larissa. It's a pleasure to be here.
And it's become a bit of an annual tradition that we have you in towards the end of the year to give a bit of a year in review. And I know you've been involved in a lot of things, so thanks for coming in to help us unpack some of those.
My pleasure.
Well, this past week has been notable on a couple of fronts, but perhaps the most distressing has been yet another death in custody of a 19-year-old man from the community of Yuendumu in Central Australia. You're a Territory girl yourself, Auntie Pat. There have been questions around the circumstances of the death of Kumanjay Walker, which led to community protests around the country. Auntie Pat, with your finger on the pulse, what have you been hearing on the ground from communities in Central Australia?
Well, they've had a few get-togethers to protest outside the police station in Alice Springs. The community itself has had a ongoing vigil and demonstrations at Yuendumu, and of course supporters right around the country have been protesting about this particular incident. Very sad, very unfortunate, and a lot of questions need to be answered. First of all, I think sending the team in to the house instead of working through the community elders and the family to bring the young man in voluntarily to the police station, because he was out on release and he needed to go back into custody. So I just think that there were much better ways of handling it, which were not utilised by the police. So it resulted in the death of a 19-year-old man, which is not acceptable in Australia in this day and age. Of most concern to me is that there was no health service staff in Yuendumu at the time of this incident. So once the man was shot, he was taken to the police station. I would imagine that the police training is in first aid is fairly rudimentary, and hardly able to match that of a fully trained doctor, nurse, health workers who deal with these situations, well, not shootings, but deal with serious injuries more in their line of work than the police in terms of rendering medical assistance. So it took over well over an hour for the ambulance to come from Yuendumu, a nearby community, because there were no health staff left in Yuendumu. They'd been evacuated apparently because of break-ins. But I asked the question, you know, well, what is the duty of care of the Northern Territory Department of Health in the provision of health services? And I'm a bit over hearing about staff having to be evacuated because of a break-in. I want serious answers given to what was the nature of the break-in, how serious was, were lives threatened, was it absolutely necessary to evacuate all the staff? I think those questions have to be answered because every community deserves ready access to primary health care, and that was obviously not available to the citizens of Yuendumu. The Walpiri people are very strong, but they're also very saddened and grieving deeply for the loss of this young man, and they want justice done. There will be an independent inquiry by ICAC in the Northern Territory, and, of course, the coroner inquest. The community have asked, as I understand it, for that to be done quickly, not take the usual 12 months, but to make sure a thorough and proper investigation by the coroner is undertaken. What it raises, though, is the recruitment practices of the Northern Territory Police and the actual training, which is obviously inadequate in terms of people working in remote areas where English is not a first language and very strong traditional lifestyles are adhered to. I say that this young man had apparently had served in Afghanistan. I don't know whether he suffered from the usual trauma that our soldiers unfortunately have to contend with, and whether he had any of that post-traumatic stress as a result of his serving in Afghanistan. But if he did, he's certainly not the right sort of person to be sending out to work in Aboriginal communities. And I think that's a big question that needs to be answered by the Commissioner for Police in the Northern Territory. And I don't think that they should be recruiting soldiers who've had that post-traumatic stress and maybe still suffering from it, because it's not something that can be dealt with immediately. It's something that takes a long time of very professional treatment to enable our returned veterans to be able to resume a normal life. So that's the first area that I point to. The second area is the Aboriginal police staff that are recruited in the Northern Territory. I think it's high time that their cultural knowledge, language skills, an ability to communicate with people in their own languages has long been undervalued in the Northern Territory Police. I think those skills are more important than some of the whatever skills the outsiders bring to the Northern Territory. People who are not Aboriginal, who don't understand the communities. And I think that our Aboriginal police need to be on the same ranking as the other police recruits and have access to the same career paths within the police force in the Northern Territory, and that's not happening. To the best of my knowledge, there have been a few recruits, and those who have been recruited have done very well and try to do the best to look after our people and ensure their safety as much as anybody else's. For a young man to be shot dead in front of family is just totally and absolutely unacceptable. I believe that there are still unimplemented recommendations from the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody, and really every jurisdiction needs to revisit that and really get on with the job. There are far too many deaths in custody. This was a death in the young man's family home, so it's just as bad as any death in custody, and I hope that the families get justice out of this.
I'm sure we'll all be watching developments in the case over the coming weeks. Another big story this week, Aunty Pat, centred around the recently announced senior advisory group to guide the co-design of an Indigenous voice to Parliament. And not surprisingly, you're involved in that group. You've had experience being the CEO of ATSIC, as well as being highly involved with the community-controlled sector. What elements do you consider imperative to a final model?
Well, I think that there's been a lot talked about in terms of a voice to Parliament, and, you know, the government has changed that priority to a voice to government. And I think it's important that all of our people make known their views in relation to this. It'll more likely, under this current government, be a legislated process, which is what our people don't want, because they've seen the demise of former federal bodies established for our benefit and then abolished. And there's been a long history of that in Australia, which is precisely why people wanted some sort of head of power in the Constitution to enable our people to work directly with the Australian Parliament on all matters impacting on our affairs and our communities and our people. Nevertheless, this government has ruled out constitutional enshrinement. The Labor Party hasn't. There was the first meeting of the Senior Advisory Committee, and it's really just a very initial meeting to understand that there will be subcommittees or other committees that are under the Senior Advisory Committee looking at what the regional structures should be and what the national structure should be and how they should be brought into effect, I guess. The advice is to government, but I think we need to have a very open and transparent process and keep people posted on progress and enable people to have a real say, because there's been a long history of reports done on constitutional recognition and how you enable an engagement of First People to give effect to full self-determination, but to enable a proper partnership with the Australian Parliament. So I think it's a first step to get arrangements in place. I think nothing is off the table. Not as far as I'm concerned, nothing's off the table. I think that regional authorities, building on the powers of the regional councils, are the way to go. But, you know, let's hear from what our people want. And but they have to have autonomy. They have to have their own community development funding with less red tape and more ability for decisions to be made by elected representatives from our own groups across the country.
When you were CEO of ATSIC, you obviously oversaw a structure that had a regional layer as a very important critical level of that.
Yes.
And it seems to be that that conversation about regional governance remains consistent. From your perspective, with all of your experience, why is that the level that communities seem to always gravitate to when we have these questions about representation, leadership and participation?
Well, I think it's driven culturally. So you can get a cultural alliance in a region where they've always had migration and trading and ceremonies and whatever. Ceremonies go a lot further than just a region, of course. They go across the country. But, you know, there's lots of things that bind people at a regional level. A lot of communities are far too small for local representation, and there's safety and strength in numbers. So I think our people are very pragmatic about that. And they realise the role of the state and territory governments becoming increasingly more important in service delivery. So, you know, they want to be able to work on a basis where they can interact with all levels of government. Regional arrangements allow that to happen more smoothly, I believe. So I think people underestimate the cultural linkages at a regional level. But I think there's a natural affinity with that, and they feel more comfortable doing things that way. As long as everyone gets an opportunity to have representation and to be listened to and have processes whereby they can determine priorities based on what the communities really want.
Last time we spoke to you, you were continuing to develop a partnership between the federal government and the country's peak Indigenous community-controlled organisations. You have continued to advocate for greater partnership in that area. How's it progressing?
Yes, well, it's progressing very well, Larissa, I'm very pleased to say. So the partnership agreement with the Coalition of Peaks and all the Australian governments was signed, came into effect in March, so it's only 4 months after the decision was made at COAG to enter into a partnership with us as representatives of our constituencies, the peak Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander community-controlled organisations. So we now have a membership of around 50 organisations at both the national level and the state and territory level that are involved in the Coalition of Peaks. We've just completed a survey where we went out and asked anybody to give us feedback. 70% of the respondents were Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander individuals or organisations, and astounding level of participation with over 1,660 responses to the survey. It was a little complex, but we'll learn from that and make it more streamlined in the future. We also conducted over 50 face-to-face engagements with our people across the country. And this has all been done within the space of a couple of months, Larissa. So we're busy compiling the results of the survey and the feedback from those engagements. When we did the engagements at the community level, the state and territory governments in the main funded our community-controlled organisations and worked with us to convene those meetings and assisted with all of the arrangements and the notes. So it's been a really very successful, productive partnership. And whatever new arrangement the federal government comes to as a result of the voice is at the regional and national level to the federal government must take account of what's happening within state and territory governments, and they should be very closely negotiated with.
As a result of now having put these things in place and that enormous amount of work that you've just described that you've been doing, what's your hope now in terms of how that Close the Gap agenda might be rolled out?
Yeah, so we had the partnership agreement signed. That's a very high-level overarching document. But we undertook the engagements and the survey to get widespread input into the new national agreement on closing the gap that all governments will sign up to with us. So we consulted on our reform priorities and we've had extraordinarily strong support for those. We compile that, we'll get it ready. We've got a partnership working group between the Coalition and PICS and the senior officials on the 22nd of November. And we will have a meeting where the Coalition and PICS reps meets with the ministers and the president of the Local Government Association and Ken Wyatt, the federal minister for Indigenous Affairs, and I co-chair the Joint Council. So we'll go to Joint Council early next year with the draft national agreement. And hopefully they will endorse it and then we can put it to the first minister's meeting of COAG, the Prime Minister, the Premiers and the Chief Ministers and the President of the Local Government Association. And hopefully they will sign that off with us and we'll have a new agreement that will last over the next 10 years and it will include all of the work that needs to be done by all of us to get a very marked improvement in the quality of life for our people across the country.
Obviously, one issue that has been on everyone's radar this year and progressed by many states has been the issue of a treaty. You travel around the country, you'd be seeing those different processes. What's your thought on that? And what does that mean at the federal level?
Yes, well, very interesting and a fantastic initiative, of course, on the part of Victoria and now Queensland and the Northern Territory. I think that it'd be fair to say the federal government would like that state level and territory level treaty process to be done throughout the country and see what's left for them. But one of the important factors with the state level treaties is that the states administer the land. And at the heart of our raison d'etre as First Nations people is our land, as is our culture, is our everything. It's very important that these land processes are fully dealt with, I reckon, at the state level, but not to usurp the national legislation on native title or on the Northern Territory Land Rights Act, which we will always want under Commonwealth control. But then you have got some remarkable arrangements under states' land rights with the APY lands in the northwest of South Australia and others and the New South Wales Aboriginal Land Rights Act. So some of these other states have really got to get on with it. But I think the Commonwealth's probably saying, phew, and breathing a sigh of relief that the states have started. But I still think it's a good initiative and I think it'll put more pressure on the federal government to look at the unique status of First Nations people, even once the state and territory level treaties are enacted, the Commonwealth has to start thinking about where does it fit and what is it going to do for a lasting final sort of acknowledgement and recognition of us taking our rightful place in our own country. And I think there's a lot more for the Commonwealth to do, but at the moment they're probably thanking their lucky stars the states have started.
Well, as I said earlier, it's a bit of a tradition to get your snapshot of the year in review, and it is a tradition to ask you to give a bit of a report card to both sides of Parliament on how they've gone during the year. So can we start with what sort of a report card you would give the Scott Morrison government?
Look, I think in terms of a scorecard, okay. The historic appointment of Ken Wyatt as the first Aboriginal person to a cabinet post, which is what we've always called for. And I think there's a very strong obligation on the part of the Liberal Party and the Nationals to back Ken all the way and not just throw him into the frying pan and leave him to burn alone, which a lot of people suspect. My call is for the government to back Ken all the way and enable him to do the best possible job. He represents us in the cabinet, and to enable him to do that, he's got to have the confidence of all of his party. I want to see what this next budget contains, because we're still waiting for the $500 million to be reimbursed that Hockey and Abbott ripped off us a few years ago. And the Prime Minister has put a high priority on youth suicide, and especially in Aboriginal communities. So we want to see that reflected in the budget figures, with that money going directly to Aboriginal community-controlled initiatives to address suicide and mental health initiatives, and not being channeled through every other organisation and its dog. And I think that the Prime Minister needs to understand that while there's been a huge focus on funding for women and domestic violence, that none of that mainstream money has hit our organisations to the extent that it should and in response to the need. So we're trying to get governments across the board to understand that they need to change the way they work with our people, and they need to negotiate with our people, not just come out and say, well, have I got a program for you? Or to continue to fund non-Indigenous organisations to deliver services to us that we can do much better than anyone else.
What sort of report card would you give Anthony Albanese's opposition?
Well, I think the Labor Party's been in shell shock for too long, and I'm glad that Anthony Albanese is starting to chart a new pathway. And I'm glad that Linda Burney is our Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Affairs Shadow Minister. I think Linda's an extremely competent Member of Parliament, and we work extremely well with her. We really want cross-party support on Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander matters. We're sick of being wedged, but the Labor Party has said that they will deliver on the Uluru Statement from the Heart and constitutional recognition and just get on with it. But it's easy to say when you're in opposition. So their true record will count when they actually deliver that. I've found the Shadow Minister, Chris Bowen, really good to work with. So I must go back to the Morrison government and the working relationship that I have in my day-to-day job as CEO of NACHO with Minister Hunt, who I find exceptionally supportive and excellent. So he last week attended the NACHO conference in Darwin. And for the first time in goodness knows how long, we're getting an additional $90 million given directly to our services at the local level, our Aboriginal medical services across the country, plus an additional $31 million in indexation. We've never had this before. We've argued long and hard for this money. And we're also working with the department on a needs-based funding formula, which will hopefully be finalised by mid-next year. So that money starts to flow to our organisations on the 1st of July, and it's the first major injection we've had for so long you wouldn't believe it. That's because of our lobbying, but also Greg Hunt hearing our voices and responding appropriately. You know, he's willing to accord the absolute priority in Aboriginal health, and I'm very happy to work with him to make sure that those investments continue in the right areas. It's no money to be sneezed at. We're very grateful, and we will make the absolute best use of that additional funding.
It has been a very big year for you, Aunty Pat. Probably not much different to any other year where it's frantic and frantic and you're involved in every major important thing, which is why we're so lucky to have you with us this evening. But from your personal point of view, what were your highs and lows of 2019?
Well, the highs have been the Sir Roland Wilson Foundation announced a new scholarship for Aboriginal public servants doing postgraduate studies. So five scholarships named after me, by the way, the Pat Turner Scholarship.
How fantastic.
Yeah, which was, I feel very humbled, but I'm very proud of that. So they're doing well. Another five have just been announced starting next year. So it's a rolling program for 5 years. So it's great. It's great. And all postgraduates with Charles Darwin and ANU in partnership. So that was a proud personal moment, I guess. And then just the work of Nacho and what we've been able to achieve has just been continuous improvement and engagement and very strong partnerships right across the board. I'm pleased with the way that we're progressing our planning on ending rheumatic heart disease, because 98% of Australians who suffer rheumatic heart disease are our people, and primarily in Northern Australia. And our mission in End Rheumatic Heart Disease Coalition is that no child born today will die of rheumatic heart disease. So we've got to get our endgame strategy funded, which is additional to the vaccine development and the research work. It's got nothing to do with research. This next stage is about putting resources at the community level, engaging with the community and really getting a strong integrated arrangement to eradicate this very debilitating disease that affects primarily our children. So we have kids as young as five having open heart surgery, Larissa. It's just tragic and totally preventable. And if we, of course, over the next 5 to whatever years, develop the world's first vaccine to eradicate it, then we will contribute that to the world, which is a fantastic initiative. But we need to get this on the ground work to eradicate rheumatic heart disease funded. And we are producing the best evidence we can to the government to enable that to happen. So I'm very excited and buoyed by that because I just want this disease eradicated. So there are a few of the highs, which is good that I've had some.
Just finally tonight, you've had such a big year, so many things to have really put your energy into. How are you spending Christmas and the new year? I hope you're taking a break.
Well, I'm taking about 2 weeks because I want to get that new national agreement on closing the gap signed off by COAG. So we've got a bit of work to do in the new year. I am going to take a few days to go and have some massages and whatever between Christmas and New Year. And I'm really looking forward to that with my sister. Other than that, we're just going to stay at home and have a quiet Christmas and New Year and then take off down to Kangaroo Valley for 4 days for the retreat, and then we'll decide whether we have a wild New Year or not.
Well, I'm sure either way, I'm glad that you're taking just a little break because you're going to have to recharge those batteries. It sounds like in 2020 you'll be hitting the ground running.
Yeah.
Well, Aunty Pat, thank you so much. Obviously, just listening to you tonight gives us just a snapshot of how many things that you're taking leadership of across the community. So it's been such a privilege, as always, to have you here on Speaking Out this evening to share your experiences, your thoughts and your reflections.
Thank you very much, Larissa.
Aunty Pat Turner is the CEO of the National Aboriginal Community Controlled Health Organisation.
You're listening to Speaking Out.
It just comes down to showing, sharing, you know, respecting
the world from an Indigenous perspective on ABC Radio.
This is Speaking Out on ABC Radio, Radio National, Radio Australia, on podcast and the ABC Listen app. I'm Larissa Berendt, and if you like what you're hearing, why not rate us on your app, and that way other people can find us and hear our stories too. The Sydney Festival will again thrill audiences in January with 46 new commissioned works planned for the 3-week event. The program features critical works of theatre, the visual arts and installations across the wider city. Sydney region, from the CBD to Parramatta. You'll hear from Festival Director Wesley Enoch shortly, but right now some music from Torres Strait Islander singer-songwriter Mal Power. Here he is alongside Marcus Corowa with Arrived.
Racing the flow, illuminated like city lights. Like I live for this moment, I rose to this life. Light flashing, pictures of grand stage arenas. Went to a believer, this has never been Marilla. Picked out this vision from a moment in my dream. Took scripts of Paulo Coelho, alchemy can be real. A fugitive of my past, living life on the run. Sacrifice what I am for what I'm about to become. In a birth of this moment, the only opponent, my mind. We going down to the wire, put it all on the line. With every fiber of my being, I come to claim what is mine. In my race against time, it's my will to survive. I'm inspired more than ever to keep dreams alive. The criticism has no value, so I pay them no mind. And if the divine can take the time to turn water to wine, then I can take the time to turn my darkness to light.
I've took the time for many days and many nights. I've seen the sun dance with the goddess of night. Yes, I know.
Prison cells manifested this mind. The plans were of God, a grand organized design. It's something cosmic when rhyme captures time. The past and the present defining each line. In the universal state, possibilities awake. Those who don't awake, greatness will forsake. Put faith in all mistakes, aligning with the great. The only question worth asking, do I have what it takes? Every day is savage, battling challenges. May passion be the catalyst to resurrect the Lazarus. The hustle is deep in this complex labyrinth. Just trying to survive brings a whole new madness. Maybe this is vanity confused with shine. Maybe too complex to be put into rhyme. The only thing we know for sure, we expire in time. So what will be the story that you leave behind?
That's Mal Power and Marcus Corowa with Arrived.
This is Speaking Out.
That's the key to it all, keeping connected to country.
On ABC Radio.
For more than four decades, the Sydney Festival has challenged and delighted audiences with a bold program of critical art and cultural performances. Held over 3 weeks in January, the event has become an important fixture for presenting Australian premier shows, supporting local artists, as well as attracting international headline acts. For the past 3 years, Wesley Enoch has been the festival director, bringing an Indigenous perspective to the role, and I'm pleased to welcome him back to the program. Wesley, welcome back to Speaking Out.
Thank you, Larissa.
What are the challenges of pulling together a program that has to have something for everyone like the Festival of Sydney does?
Yeah, people often say, oh, do you love everything in the festival? We go, actually, it's not, the festival isn't always mine. What I'm doing is helping curate things for others. And so it's trying to understand the tastes of audiences. For me, I've always loved new work. And so this year we've got 46 new commissions, which is a pretty massive undertaking. But then you go, there's always something in the free environment that, you know, that people should bring families and kids to and things. So what I need to do is always stay very open. And I think every good arts leader should be open to discussion and debate and new ways of working, and that the festival doesn't become stuck in its history. And as you and I would know, you know, history is written by those who are maybe just not us. So for us to rewrite history and to say, what's the new thing Sydney's looking for? That's my job. That's the hardest thing to do, to say, convince everyone else, actually, come on the new journey. Don't just believe in the things you've gone to in the past.
So you've been festival director since 2017, three festivals. How have you grown over that time, and what lessons are you taking from 1 year to the next?
I think the last festival I did, 2019, this one gone, it was the closest to what I want the festival to be, which is about being a provocation, if you like, to say big ideas to the world. My earlier festivals were as much about what the staff were kind of bringing in, what was in the cupboard coming down the line. And as I've seen now, when I was talking about these big commissions, it takes you 3 years just to get some of these big things to land. Like one of the things that we're doing, Black Ties, it's taken us 3 years of negotiations and conversations to get to the point where that work is ready to go on the stage. And if you're a first-time director, you can't do that. Like my background's mostly as a theatre director and a writer. And so I'm often attracted to the new in a way that people who are professional professional festival directors go, they just go shopping and find things. I go, oh, actually, what's the new voice? And I think what distinguishes the Sydney Festival is that new voice is really right about now. Artists are talking about issues that are facing us now.
You're directing a play in this festival, which takes you back to your old theatre background, and it's something you haven't done for a while. It's called Black Cockatoo. What can you tell us about it?
It's a play written by Geoffrey Atherton, and it looks at the first international touring cricket team from Australia, which was an all-Indigenous team in 1868. And it was interesting because when Geoffrey came to talk to me about the play, and he was interested in, you know, what the interface was. He's a non-Indigenous writer. And I was going, oh, well, you know, what I would do straight away is just cast an all-Indigenous cast so that they can talk about the white reception as well as the black experience of going over there. And he said, well, that's a good idea. And he just rewrote the play. And in our first meeting, a white cockatoo came and sat outside my window. And I was saying to Geoffrey, I don't know what that means, but that means something. And as he did the research, black cockatoo comes from the skin name, the totem of Johnny Muller, who was the lead player. And as it turns out, white cockatoo is the right marrying. So white cockatoo, black cockatoo is the right marrying, right skin. And I was going, oh, well, there you go. We've got to do it together now anyway. And it's happening at the ensemble. And I think that what I'm really looking forward to is being back in a rehearsal room, and I said outside, it's the first time I'm back in a rehearsal room since the passing of David Page. And David and I were wonderful collaborators. He did so many shows with me over the 25 years. And his loss, it's one of those things that I haven't been into a rehearsal room without him in a show like this. And so, you know, Black Diggers or, you know, I did Mother Courage. And for his presence, which was always generous and a beautiful musical experience, and his generosity of spirit and his age as well was always good. And I'm remembering him before I go into this room. So we'll see.
Bittersweet.
Yeah, I think it's also this fear, because I haven't been in a rehearsal room for a while, and it's a very important story that I've got Luke Carroll, who I've worked with a lot, so that's great to have him in there, and Shanoa Diamal, who's come from Queensland, and I know her. But there's a sense of going, oh, in my collaborative embrace, he's missing, and he would have been a great role model for the other actors as well.
One challenge for the festival, particularly for you as an Indigenous festival director, has been that it does fall on Australia Day. Mm. And perhaps more than other festival directors, you've been under a bit of scrutiny as to how you approach that day that means such different things to different people. How have you approached it, and how has your thinking about how we mark that day changed over time?
Yeah, I haven't rushed into it. I mean, my first festival, I said, oh, well, let's go with what has done before, because this is something that needs thoughtfulness. And in my second festival, I started the conversation about saying, you know, change the date, don't change the date. But what does the day even mean? And this history of the 26th of January, what does it mean? Because a lot of us are just thoughtless about it. You know, our countrymen and women out there are a bit thoughtless about what the day even means. And so in this festival just happened, I've started doing this the 25th of January to say, okay, let's look at the day before the arrival of the First Fleet as a way of, if you like, remembering the day before, in this case, Eora, had to deal with that big change in their lives, the big shifts. And so for me, it's about having conversations. I also was saying in a lot of my preamble, saying we need to have a national day that almost reflects Anzac Day, which is our other national day, which is unique to Australia, which has multiple ceremonies, multiple rituals throughout the day. Like the 26th of January has very few rituals. And in fact, the Lamb Ad is one of those things really, that we look at every year and go, oh, that's what we should do. But it's interesting that newly arrived Australians, people who are naturalised on that day, get more ceremony than non-Indigenous Australians who have just inherited that day as their day. So for me, I want blackfellas, for us to have ceremony, to remember what it was like the day before, for us to also use that as a way to talk about the whole nation remembering our 60, 100,000, 150,000 year history, rather than just this little bit of history that we've had this last 230 years. So for me, I think there's something bigger that we need to do, and the more ceremony we can make, the better. So we're doing in the 2020 festival, we're coming through the city smoking it on the 25th of January, saying, let's cleanse, let's do a proper cleanse. And especially the different streets in Sydney, like George Street, which was a thoroughfare for millennia. People going up and down there, Pitt Street going up and down there with the tank stream. We have a history of walking up and down these spaces. So we're doing that. And then the vigil, which we introduced in the 2019 festival, we were asking people to come and sit vigil from dusk of the 25th through till dawn of the 26th as a way of, again, just thinking about the First Nations experience in this country.
The other conversation, of course, that you've had to think about is what to do with Cook. 2020 is obviously a very significant anniversary of that. How have you explored that idea in not just this festival, but the festival last year leading up to it?
Well, Cook's one of those things, he's one of those foundation myths, stories in our foundation of this country. And in the 2020 festival, I've been working with Brooke Andrew, he had this idea of the 250 flagpoles. And we're calling the project Proclamation, this notion of somehow by putting a flag up, you can say you own something, which is a kind of a weird idea for a First Nations, you know, community to go, what does a piece of cloth flapping in the wind, why do you have that? So for us, we're asking the people of Sydney to design flags, and we'll put flags all through Barangaroo Reserve and saying, think about what it means for your ownership of place if you put a flag up. What does it, has it deepen your experience? Does it not deepen your experience? And what does it mean for Cook? I mean, I've got this wonderful thing, the Sutherland Shire, they changed their logo and it's now a face of Cook. And you look at all their garbage bins, they just have Cook stamped on all their garbage bins. And I go, did you think about that? Did you think about it? But I think that Cook is a very interesting narrative, especially in a Brexit environment, because he's a thread of empire that threads, in this case, New Zealand, Australia, a lot of the South Pacific, and that his story is becoming more and more important, less so for Australia, I think, but more so for a Brexiteering England or Britain, as they try to say, we need empire, we need Commonwealth to keep our trading up. And you go, well, you actually need to understand our counter-narrative to that and how we have grown up in a different direction.
Not surprisingly, one of the contributions you've really made to the festival in your time as artistic director is to really ramp up the Indigenous program in a whole range of ways. So I was wondering if you could talk to us a bit about the highlights, but maybe start with a show that you've already mentioned, Black Ties.
Oh yeah, Black Ties is fantastic. Ilbidri, beautiful company from Melbourne, and Taria, the Maori company from Auckland. If you imagine this, an Aboriginal man marries a Maori woman and their two families meet at the reception. The first act of the play is the families getting to meet, you know, their prospective in-law. And then the second act is the reception where these two families come together. And anyone who's been to a blackfellow wedding, you know how kind of rambunctious and loud and funny, great dancing, great music. And there's a wonderful sense of humour where they go into some terrible, terrible kind of troubling circumstances that you're just laughing out loud. It's such a celebration. And we're going to do it at Sydney Town Hall, where we split the whole hall into full blackfella cast, lots of, you know, blackfella designers, everyone kind of coming together to show what a big, large-scale work can be like that. That's going to be a lot of fun, a lot of fun.
Including Jack Charles, who's a bit of a favourite here at Speaking Out.
Well, Jack Charles plays a septuagenarian social media tart. He's constantly live tweeting during the show. Well, I don't know if he is, but that's his character is doing that. And we love Uncle Jack for that too, that he's always happy to play the cheeky little character too that he can.
And what else is in the Blackout program?
Oh, well, talking about the Cook anniversary, Nadi Simpson and her collaborators are making this fantastic work called the Black Drop Effect, which is looking at Cook's journey, because the scientific journey was to measure the distance of the Earth to Venus and all of that kind of stuff. So she's using that as the beginning point for a conversation. And they're doing it at Bankstown, remembering that Joseph Banks travelled up the river at one point and Bankstown's named after him. And so there's a whole conversation around that. There's immersive music and visual experience there. Another show I'm looking forward to is called The Visitors, a Mughlan, fantastic local company. Jane Harrison wrote a play called Stolen, Rainbow's End, a number of others. She's written this piece called The Visitors, the premise being seven Eora representatives come together on the 26th of January 1788 to have a discussion whether to let the boats land or not. She did some research around 12 Angry Men, which was a play set like a courtroom drama play. And so she's using that as the way of arguing should they not, back and forward. So that'll be a lot of fun as well. There's heaps of visual arts. Fiona Foley has a retrospective. Vernon Arkey has some work. Daniel Boyd has a fantastic video installation at Carriage Works. I mean, look, there's so much. The best way is to get online and check it all out, which is sydneyfestival.org.au, and the Blackout program, as well as a whole range of other things.
You have been very good about engaging other communities. You've spoken about your very careful planning around Indigenous content, but you have sought to engage other cultural groups in the festival as well.
Yeah, and especially the last festival, 2019 festival. Well, I always work from the idea that a neglected audience, a starved audience, is a hungry audience. And we found at the last festival, if you have a couple of works which are about diversity, they just book out like that. We've got a work in the 2020 festival called Double Delicious, which is five Asian, well, some are Asian, Australian, and some are Singaporean, but they tell stories and make food in front of you. And then everyone in the audience gets to taste the food. This sense of, you know, we all know this, story is in what you eat as well, that all of those elements, the senses coming together. And by sharing food with someone who is different to you, perhaps, or someone who is like you, that you get a different experience. And Benjamin Law is doing that one as well, which we love Ben because he's such a raconteur. And so him telling a story, making some food and others there, that's a really wonderful piece to look at. There's another piece which is a little bit different. 12 people, it's called Truth Machine. 12 people go in and answer a few questions, and then the computer randomly selects one, and then you get hooked up to a polygraph machine and asked, you know, questions in front of the rest of the audience. What's the truth? What's not the truth? Because that's a big issue at the moment.
Gosh, that's audience participation on steroids, isn't it?
Yeah, that'll be a fun thing to do.
There are obviously all of these little gems within the festival, and as you say, to get online and have a look through them all. But what are some of the big headline shows that you've got this year?
Well, Brand New Day, people will know about that, the 30th anniversary of that fantastic musical. There's a piece called Joan Didion's The White Album, which is looking at her essays about the 1960s. There's also Isabelle Adjani, a French superstar, is coming to star in a new work called Opening Night, not to be confused with the opening night of the festival, but Opening Night, the play based on the John Cassavetes film. There's so many things, fantastic dance works as well, Colossus by Stephanie Lake. I could go on and on and on. But the big things are also about families. So we've got the Flying Fruit Fly Circus to come and perform. And I think it's especially, let's say, for young Aboriginal kids, and Torres Strait Islander kids, this notion of your physical body and giving yourself strength and power. Come along and see the Fruit Fly Circus. That's always a great thing. And a Laserbeak Man, which is Dead Puppet Society doing their bringing to life the cartoons and drawings of Tim Sharp.
You still have two festivals to go, but already after three, you've started to explore some trends and find your way through the things that are interesting for you. What do you hope your legacy will be with Sydney Festival?
I think the appetite from the audiences for change, for new things, for looking beyond the horizon. I hope too that our Indigenous program, our Blackout program, does never shrink, but grows and becomes more and more popular. And I think for me, the city of Sydney needs to keep being jolted, if you like, out of its comfort zone. It is the big international city of Australia. We understand that. But it can't be complacent. It has to be a leader. And especially around the Australia Day discussion, a First Nations discussion, this is the beginning point of that black and white conversation. And we have to be leaders of that in Sydney. How do we keep prototyping change? That's my big goal.
I just want to pick up on that because I think one of the very interesting things you have really done in your time as artistic director is really try and have the festival be a moment at which we start to have conversations that we can carry on through the year about these big thematics. But I wonder what your reflections are more generally about the role of our Indigenous creatives, our Indigenous storytellers in those big thematics like the things coming out of the Uluru Statement, treaty, truth-telling, voice. Yes. What are your thoughts about the role that our creatives have to play in those conversations?
Well, I think voice in particular is one of those things that, let's say theatre, I'm a theatre director and writer, this notion of the lived experience of most non-Indigenous people is that they don't meet us. They don't have a conversation with us. And so therefore our art is often the thing that they are engaging with, that they see us on television, in the cinemas, on the stages, they read our books. And that gives them an insight into our experiences and what our hopes and dreams are. So for me, our creatives are, like our sports people, the front line on which a lot of the voice to the rest of the country is being manifest. Now, yes, I hope absolutely for a voice to Parliament, but you know, that seems to be a long and torturous road. But what we continue to do is to say to the rest of the nation, we have our sovereignty in our own voice. And the more we use it, the more we talk about it, the better it is. I think treaty is one of those inescapable, it's got momentum. The rest of the country cannot avoid that there is sovereignty for Indigenous Australians, that treaty is the way forward, and that eventually, and we're talking maybe in the next 10 years, 50 years, 100 years, it will have to be addressed. They cannot outwait us. We are a very patient people. I mean, I love that thing in the Gurindji where they just waited and waited and waited. Truth and justice will always out. And for me, I'm seeing the next generation really getting vibed off this sense of their own empowerment. I love this idea of the inverted population pyramid at the moment where, you know, almost half of the Aboriginal population is under 30. The sense of our future is so extraordinary. And I love that I'm an old person now, you know, I'm 50, but this notion of going, how do you empower those people as I get older? How do I say, you need a voice? How do I put a microphone in front of you? How do I help you shape the rest of the nation?
Just finally this evening, we often are very interested here in speaking out about how our great leaders, the people who do all this hard community work, our great thinkers, think about well-being and resilience. And you have three very intensive weeks when the festival is on. How do you mentally and physically prepare for that in terms of your own well-being?
The diet is the big thing at the moment. I love preparing food for myself. I should eat out more often. Yes, yes, yes. I understand that. But just preparing my own food is also a mental preparation. Cleaning my house, isn't this terrible? You know, you go like getting your own home in order is part of it all. And the idea of talking to people. Don't ever feel isolated. Well-being, I think, is something that we are naturally community connected. And the more we talk to people and share our ideas and share our downs and our ups, the stronger we all are.
Well, Wesley, it's always wonderful to have you here and hear not just what you've cooked up for the festival, but also but also sharing your insights more broadly.
Thank you, Larissa.
Director of the Sydney Festival, Wesley Enoch. The Sydney Festival runs from the 8th to the 26th of January. That's the show for this week. Speaking Out is on Facebook and you can email the program speakingout@abc.net.au. We would love to hear from you. I'm Larissa Berendt and this is Speaking Out.